Episode 33, The Exit Strategy. We have Glenn Argenbright, founder of the venture capital firm Quake. Quake is a venture capital firm focused on the seed stage of all startups. We ask Glenn how he sees the market today, how things are going, and what he expects in the future. Now let's start that count.
1, 2, 3, 4.
You're listening to The Exit Strategy, a podcast that inspires open discussions about financial news and technology today. My name, Marcus Megarian, a recovering SaaS vendor, joined by my co-hosts, Ralph DeFiore and Swadek Mazumdar. And we're sitting down with startup founders, technology experts. Now let's begin.
Quake, to me, is a video game back in the 90s.
Yeah, sure.
And I love Quake. The VC and the game. It's kind of like a double entendre here.
There you go.
Nice. That's for the guy who basically runs most of the tech stuff in Chatsworth. Swadek is head-to-head with me. But Glenn, I'm so happy to have you here. It's incredible. I loved meeting you at the event there at Tocqueville Asset Management. You know, you're up to fund 4 now, I believe.
We've got 3 primary funds, and we're actually now we have 5 follow-on funds, but we're about to launch our 4th fund. That's correct.
Yeah. I mean, I'm in France. Swadek is in India. I think he just flew back to New York. Ralph is down in Florida. Glenn, you're over in New York, right?
I actually moved out of Brooklyn back to Seattle during the pandemic. Back this way. And I don't know if that was a good move or a bad move, but at the time it seemed like a good move.
What did Jeff Bezos do?
Well, I think he went to Sun Valley, Idaho, to be blunt. Or an island somewhere. I'm not sure which, but we don't see him around town as much.
I need the Jeff Bezos money. That's the thing. It's the way to live your life. It's very important. But Glenn, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. Introduce yourself. I mean, Quake is an amazing fund for the seed startup scene. It's been around for quite a bit of time. It really has tremendous amounts of experience from the investment stage to the exit stage. Being the exit strategy, you are in a perfect place to discuss what you do.
Well, first off, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. Little bit on Quake. Sure, we've been around for about little over five years now. Moving in on 6 years, actually 5.5 years in. I have kind of a contrarian background for a fund manager, so I think the fund is a little contrarian as well. So my background is primarily as a startup founder. So I launched and was very active startup founder, launched 14 of them, exited 9 of them, ended up having 3 of them that went public. So got a reputation for knowing how to do exits. So then I ended up doing some work for some hedge funds, as you might imagine, to help them fix broken toys and see if I could get, you know, exits for some of those companies. And then years ago, I was looking with some other family offices at some early stage deals at an event that I was at and realized that families really struggled to do early stage investing. Check size too small, diligence is difficult, all the things you guys already know. And so we decided we were going to launch a fund. Well, I don't know as I decided I was going to launch a fund. I kicked around the idea of launching a fund to focus on things that families like. So infrastructure, logistics, transportation, a lot of these old line businesses that have been around for a long time, lots of buyers, lots of exits, which we'll talk about today, and figure out if there's a way that we could build a vehicle that would allow families to participate at the earlier stage, which, you know, at that point I now have 400 personal venture investments myself through my family. And then through Quake, we have 275. So just very, very active early stage investor. Learned quite a long time ago, that's where a lot of the real gravy lives. I mean, if you look at like the Uber exit, it becomes very clear very quickly who's making the money in that deal. So that's what the thesis was. Like I said, we now got, you know, multiple funds, 275 investments. But what's really fascinating is, and I think this is also a worthy conversation, is that we did a lot of things on the risk mitigation side, which I think a lot of investors, there's a lot of things you can do that a lot of investors fail to do. So I think if you look at our portfolio 5.5 years in, our survival rate is almost 90%. Most venture funds focused on early stage would be at around 40%. So I think, you know, when you start to look at the places, and this is very easy to do, you start to look at the studies like Startup Genome that tell you where startups fail, and you start to really key in on those things. And the same can, you know, I know today we want to talk a little bit about exits, but the same thing there is really exits aren't organic. They don't just have, they can, but that's a really crappy way to go about doing an exit. Exits are strategically planned and executed. And I think the same is true when you're deploying capital. So that's sort of when Quake came about. That's part of it, was kind of shake things up was the notion. That's where the name came from, and do it a little bit different and key on some of the things maybe other people were ignoring.
The exit is like the thing that like most founders think they know, but they don't know. And it's really like this whole thing that people have this imagination, or they read a case study like back in the 90s and they're like, oh, this is how we exit. And it's the fact is that like there's so many variables that come involved, like who's the buyer, how, where's the market at, where interest rates at. And there's it's like it's a moving target. And it drives me crazy when VCs come in and they're like, yeah, it's worth $100 million, but they're doing like, you know, $100,000 or $1 million in revenue. And it's like, well, how do we get to the $100 million? We could do an earn out if the buyer is interested in like doing that and getting all that stuff. But then that comes, it gets added into the liabilities in the future.
Yeah. And those rounds, it's such a good point, because those rounds, founders just, they don't really contemplate when they have access to big pools of capital, which, you know, has pulled back a little bit. But if you look in the last couple few years, like you said, some of these funds out there were throwing huge checks. And that completely changes the dynamic of getting out of the company. It makes it very, very difficult. You now suddenly have to do a $1 billion deal. You know, I keep telling these guys, well, those investors are expecting a yield. They're expecting a return. And so it's hard for founders to turn down that money, but they really do need to look at different times. Now, I want to be careful here. As an investor, obviously, we want to see deals mature out and make max return. But founders on the flip side of that also need to kind of look at, there are occasions when they can get out without taking additional dilution, without taking on that extra capital. And there are many times that that works for both the existing investors, and almost always that works out really well for the founding team and the employees. So you really do have to balance those things. And I think a lot of founders fail to do it.
Glenn, you said something interesting. By the way, is Amy still working with you?
She's actually moved down to Florida. Her passion was around crypto. Okay. So she got an opportunity to partner into a crypto fund down in Florida. And yeah, we're still in touch all the time. And she's
okay, no, because I think I've attended some events at your, I think, downtown location.
In New York?
In New York. And this is the Indian guy. I forget his name now. I can't recall.
Sumai,
that's correct. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
He's launched a startup now. He decided he wanted to go back and be a startup founder.
That's great. You know, I was a partner at a venture fund as well. And think both Quake and I, and Quake and us, we kind of looked at a few deals together. I'm not sure if we did any. But, you know, you said something interesting early on. You said, you know, you look at mitigating risk very early on. From a startup, you know, for an early stage venture fund, you know, we've struggled with that a little bit. When you are geographically so diversified, how do you do it?
That's a great question. So that is a part of our strategy as well. So in addition to risk mitigation, we're trying to get better value versus traction plays, which basically means it's hard to play in Silicon Valley. It's hard to play in Boston. It's hard to play in New York. A lot of our deals, if you look at our portfolio, would be like Cedar Rapids, Iowa, maybe the Silicon Slopes in Utah, you know, a number of deals in Texas. They're all over the place, but they're not necessarily in the biggest markets. And our average point of entry is 3.5 million entry valuation, which is unheard of, right? And especially with our survival rate. But that's what you do. If you want to find those deals, you have to look in these smaller markets. And then to mitigate the risk to that point, I'll give you an example. So about 25% of all startups fail to navigate that first major pivot. And I think everybody on this call, I know everybody on this call is very sophisticated and has dealt with startups and knows every startup pivots. So if 25% of all startups fail to navigate the first pivot, you really don't want to come in before that. You want to look at the deal. And we believe we figured out the triggers that indicate that a company, and I'll give you some of them here. It's not rocket science, but we're looking to make sure that the company has already moved past that first significant pivot point. And then another early stage thing that happens usually in the first year and a half of a startup is founder fight. You know, so everybody wants to invest in multi-founder teams, and they should, because they're far more likely to succeed than single founder. Whole boatload of reasons for that. Support, multiple people to carry the load, lots of different skill sets. Well, you know, we can go on and on. But there's an interesting thing. One founder is worse than two, is worse than three, but at four it plateaus. At five it starts to head the other direction again. It starts to get worse. And one of the reasons for that is the more founders you have, the more likely a fight is, by the way. So, and it's hard to get anything done. So that takes out about 12% of all startups. So that's another area you look at. Like, what does the founding team look like? What are their communication mechanisms? What's the, you know, accountability loop look like? Those are some of the things. In terms of the pivot point, let me go back to that real quick, because that one's one I think almost everybody gets wrong. So what we're typically looking for is revenue. And people are like, you can't get revenue. I mean, most of the folks even on this call would agree it's going to be hard to get revenue at $3.5 million. But if you look at enough deals, you can. And particularly in this environment where, you know, there's a lot of good deals out there and values come back some. Our typical deal has $30,000 to $100,000 in monthly recurring revenue at 3.5, 3.6 million in valuation. And we look for that in a period of time that we want to see 30,000, preferably closer to 100, but we want to see 30,000 in monthly recurring revenue, and we want to see it for 3 to 6 month period of time. And we want to see, leading into that, we want to see another 3 to 6 month window of roughly 20% growth month over month. And that's a really unique set of characteristics, but if you put them together, you can almost be assured that that company has already gone through its first pivot. It's just, we've looked at tens of thousands of deals, probably over 100,000 deals, and we see it routinely over and over and over. So that's what we do. Geography plays into it, but more so for us, that's probably on the valuation side more than the risk mitigation side. A lot of funds like to look in their backyard. We don't really have a backyard. We've got offices in New York, Austin, LA, up here, I guess, if you just count me. And then we've got a cohabitation with, we've got a space in Deutsche Telekom's headquarters in Cologne, Germany. So we're all over the place. And so for us, it's not about being in our backyard. We don't really have that luxury.
How are things going in Austin?
Austin's still a good market. You know, I think it's going to take a hit, though, because it's so heavy on SaaS. You know, Austin's like, I would in many ways argue the SaaS capital. And I think SaaS is going to get a little bit of an awakening if the economy, it sort of depends where the economy goes. But, you know, just based on my history in the early 2000s, 2001, 2008, you know, just seeing how major pullbacks impact corporate enterprise budgets, where they want to spend their money. Certainly they'll spend on efficiency, but I think SaaS is oversaturated. I think it'll take a hit. And look, it's been kind of easy to do something in SaaS for a while. They need an adjustment.
SaaS is great because it's like 90% margins is what everyone's looking for. And like these 30% growths, and you could do it because like everyone was dumping so much cash into the thing. And then like, it's like it's a bad cycle when you have 5.5% interest rates.
And you don't have much of a moat, you know? So that's the challenge. You have to pick your battle, right? You're going to have you're either a margin or moat. And, you know, people don't like, I'm not going to tell people to get into hardware. That's not I've done hardware, software, middleware, firmware. I've done it all, but hardware's hardest. I mean, for sure. Cause it takes a lot of upfront capital. The beauty is, definitely, when things get, you got a big moat. When things get tough, you got a big moat. SaaS doesn't have that. So I think they're going to take a hit, but Austin's still a robust market.
Commercially, they have expanded tremendously, and that's probably going to be hit as well, you know, with all these companies facing revenue downfalls.
Yeah, I mean, the commercial real estate market is terrifying for all of us, but not just even on the from the economic landscape. It's going to dramatically change the way everybody works. So a lot of these investment models that we've had, I think, are, you know, kind of like we're all looking at AI, trying to figure out what's going to happen with generative AI. Nobody's talking about real estate, but it's going to have a major impact on the way workflow is done.
Yeah, it sure will. Marcus is big with that AI stuff, right, Marcus?
Well, before joining Chatsworth, I used to run this Brazilian bank. My mother used to have so many miles that I would give my mother these first class tickets to Brazil to go to the carnival. So
nice.
I ended up joining a lot of real estate things, and the upside for them was incredible. And the thing is that, like, when you start getting from 0% to 5% plus interest rates, and then mortgage rates in some states hitting 10%, I'm sorry, but that price per square foot's going to go down a bit. It doesn't. Yeah. It doesn't matter. The thing is that, like, even with a lot of these SaaS guys, they have to be, a lot of companies I speak to here in Europe, they're all stating we're gonna get profitable in next year, next 6 months, next year and a half. And it's the same story. Everybody knows what has to happen. Are startups gonna go away? No, they're not gonna go away. There's still a lot of things in the market that needs to happen, because there's a lot of inefficiencies, and there's always somebody who works in something that finds an inefficiency and says, I have a startup idea. This is how we're going to monetize it. And this is how we're going to win. And VCs like Quake obviously want those opportunities.
Yeah. And I think it, you know, if there are startup founders listening, I think that they, particularly early stage, this is a great time. You know, anytime there's a downturn, it's a great time for you. Most of my big hits happened in the wake, with the exception of my first big IPO, which came into the crash, the .com crash. After that, everything was really in the wake of a decline. And the reason for that, there's a whole ton of reasons, but you think about a big company, they have to lay off this great talent that's really specialized, and they don't really know how to work without that specialized talent. Whereas startups are a bunch of Renaissance people doing every job. That's the first thing. The second thing is that creates a talent pool that you can go grab if you do happen to have capital. Most startups are largely expected to take a long time anyway, so nobody was really counting on them to have crazy revenue, and they tend to be in R&D mode. So startups are actually a really good place, and I'm not making a pitch for Quake. I'm simply saying, I like this. I mean, I know it's I know it's not a popular sentiment, but I like down markets as an early stage investor, because I actually see our teams accelerating, closing the gap on later stage teams. Now, here's the challenge. We're already into this one for a while, right? We all can agree. This has been going on for a while. We can call it a recession. We can call it a slowdown. We can call it whatever the heck we want. It doesn't matter. The teams themselves have been in a bad situation, because COVID itself was a different sort of bad situation. So teams have been in this interesting mode for 2.5 years, 3 years almost now. And there's only so long that a startup has that advantage. And I've seen them using that and closing that gap. If we continue down this path for another 12 months or so, which I think there's a good chance we will, it will have greater impact on those later stage teams, particularly the C, D, E round teams are going to get hammered. But it will start to have a heavier impact on these early stage teams, which frankly, we really, our portfolio hasn't taken, it's, forget about taking a hit. We've grown. One of our portfolios, the multiple on invested capital in the last 90 days, increased 25% on a portfolio, right? I mean, that's huge in 90 days. So early stage is actually thriving right now, as I would expect it to. But, you know, again, you can only carry that logic so far, you know.
Glenn, I want to ask, when we first met, it was the late 90s, the internet boom. Just for context, what's different now versus the late 90s?
Wow, so much. Yeah, a lot. I mean, and some of it's good, some of it's bad. And I'll try and be somewhat PC about it too, in the sense that I think there are there's we were talking earlier about some of these big checks. I don't think those are a good thing. And I don't want to, throw anybody under the bus, but I think those cause challenges in the market for a lot of different reasons, and they create a lot of bad habits and things. But a couple quick things, Ralph, I'd talk about. One, access to capital, whole different ballgame. You know, my first IPO, $4.5 billion at its peak, right? In my tenure, we didn't even raise $1 million. And a server cost, and I'm not talking like a big tower server. I'm talking like a basic server costs like 50 to 100 grand. And you had to put coolers in your server room. And so, you know, and this is a terrible thing to say, but in the early days of that company, so we didn't look like total dumbasses, we put up racks in it. We had a server room. We put up racks. We put coolers in there. We knew we'd eventually put machines in there. We didn't have the machines. We had to bring in clients. We had one server. We had a whole bunch of faceplates with blinky lights, because otherwise it would have looked like you just look ridiculous. But that's, it would have cost us to outfit that room, would have cost us like $5 million in an environment where you couldn't possibly, Sand Hill Road wasn't deploying capital. Didn't it really, it existed, but it wasn't deploying capital. And so the access to capital, the cost of getting into it, you know, software or hardware wasn't cheap. It didn't matter if you did it in a garage, there was no cloud. There were no platforms to build on. I mean, that's if I'm a startup now, I don't want to be. The last few years, I wouldn't want to be, you know, in the sense that I wouldn't want to be the founder because it's a lot to navigate. But I would love to be a founder in this environment otherwise, because now you have so many platforms. The obvious example, Uber. Uber just leveraged. I mean, we had Magellan. We had Tomcat. We had, you know, GPS, all those GPS systems that you could have. Prior to that, you had Thomas Guide, the physical maps that you used. We had, you know, text messaging. We had a variety of different things, but you needed those platforms to build this, you know, monster that became Uber. Those are tremendous leverage opportunities that in 95, which when I arrived in Silicon Valley, we didn't have. We had Xerox. I mean, we were knocking Xerox, and that was actually a theme in the Valley. We were knocking Xerox off. Now, the other thing that's different, I don't like, and I'll try and remain PC, but I don't like that we've moved away from Merit, which was the other big focus of Quake when we formed it. I didn't care how old you were, where you lived, what your gender was, what your sexual affiliation was, what your race was. I didn't care about any of that. None of my partners cared about any of that. All we cared about was Merit. And that's Silicon Valley, 1997 to 1999, 2000, maybe 96 to 2000. And it was absolutely disruptive, transformative, and awesome. There were some negatives, but that aspect of it was awesome. It didn't matter where you went to school. Didn't matter who you knew. Didn't matter where you worked. Could you do it better than everybody else? And if you couldn't, you were gone really fast. And equity was king. If you were awesome, you moved and you got more equity, and people made a ton of money because they were meritorious. Now that's not the case anywhere. It's not the case in the Valley. The Valley's the worst of it. It's not the case in any of the copycat valleys. Now it's, where did you go to school? Who do you know? Who'd you work for? None of those things matter. None of the, and I'm not saying that individually. Startup Genome Report is the definitive study of startups and founders. Looks at, you know, 5,000 plus up to 25,000 every single year. They've looked at those. Where you went to school has no bearing whatsoever. Yeah. Where you worked has no bearing whatsoever. These things that people focus on do not matter. Can you do the job? And, you know, accountability, which we don't have anymore either. So those are, I mean, there's, it's an, I could talk for hours just on the changes, but those are the big ones. We've gotten away from what really matters in many ways.
You're right. I mean, technology hardware has become cheaper, but has become much more advanced.
Oh my gosh.
You could do so much more. I mean, going back in the 1990s, doing diligence on a company took hours sitting in a library, right? Now it's on your fingertips. It's amazing.
Right? I often laugh. We didn't have Google. I knew them. And I knew when it was a single bar. Some of you are old enough to remember when it was a single bar. And I was one of the first 50 at eBay, like one of the first 50 customers outside of their employees at eBay. Still have my account. So these things that we think of that are ubiquitous now, back then, but more importantly on the research side, though, we didn't have.
Yeah.
We didn't have any way of knowing or doing. So that's a great point.
For sure. You know, but
Glenn, what I see a lot is young companies coming to us, and they themselves have set the valuation of their company. And they've had family and friends in maybe friends of friends in, and they come in with unrealistic valuations. What do you say to those people? I tell them, well, you know, your valuation is not going to work. The market is not going to accept it. How do you get out of that trap? How do you not get into it? You know, is there a way? What would you advise young companies, I guess is what I'm saying, about setting their valuations after certain revenue numbers are met and certain obstacles are overcome?
You know, Paul Graham, the original, you know, Y Combinator, used to talk about people taking their money being a kind of a, almost a test, like a qualifier, as to the merit of the founder. Maybe, you know, some founders may not like the sounds of that, you know, whatever. I can understand that. But I would say that when we sit down with a founder, there have been many cases where that happens. The valuation's too high. We know it's too high. Look, we look like you. We look at thousands. I mean, a lot of funds say this, literally 1,000 deals plus a month. We've got a artificial intelligence engine we built 5+ years ago, probably needs some updating, but it drives a lot of deal flow for us. It drives in the applications. But the advantage a fund has looking at, let's say they're looking at 100 deals a month or 200 or 1,000 plus, they know what the landscape looks like. They know what you're up against. My biggest problem for my teams, I've told many teams the last 2 weeks, out raising funds, your problem isn't everybody else. Your problem is my startups. My own startups are competing against my startups, and mine are, in my opinion, in part because who I'm introducing them to, they're seeing the same stuff and mine are good. So it's a problem, but at the same time, knowing what's in the market, you kind of have an idea how good the market is and where they should be priced. So that's number one. Number two, we really spend a lot of time with founders, and I think you can get good, this is why I was talking about Paul Graham. Good founders will understand this. Founders you probably don't want to work with won't understand what I'm about to say, which is that this round, I don't want you to be in the business of raising money. There are founders, we've all dealt with them, everybody on this call, who get enamored with raising capital, and it's almost as if that's their business. And that's not really their business. That's just a necessary evil of the business. But you know, when you're celebrated for raising rounds, sometimes it can get really, it's addictive. But good founders generally understand that this is just something they have to do. It's not like the most important thing. So I don't want this comment to come off as sounding like it's the most important thing. But the round you're doing today is not so much about today. Today's round sets up the next one, which automatically sets up the next one. So every decision you make on funding has major implications on what we were talking about much, much earlier on this call, that now you're going to raise, you know, if you're successful, you're going to be at an outsized value at some point, far beyond, you know, to what Marcus was saying, far beyond what your revenue is. And then you're stuck and you're doing a down round and or just completely cratering. So you always have to have your valuation rationally tied to your merits, let's go back to that, to your metrics, so that the round can have the foundation it needs to do the next round. Now, I do want to say one thing. This is off topic, but it's really bugging me the last few days. We've seen some distressed deals lately, largely because there have been some funds who aren't able to honor signed docs or commitments, okay? That's happening. We all know it's happening. And as a result, those of us that do have any dry powder are kind of having to step in and shore up good deals, not even bad deals, bridge them. But I've noticed something really interesting, not just in our portfolio, but in multiple other venture partners that I'm talking to. Crowdfunding. I like crowdfunding. I think most folks generally in our space like crowdfunding. However, there's a weakness I hadn't really thought about. When you raise from a crowdfunding platform, you don't have the ability in a crisis to go back to your top. You know, you don't have 5 big institutional funds, or let's say 10 smaller institutional funds that you can go to and say, hey guys, we need to do pro rata deal. We're in a crisis here. No, you've got 1,000 individuals that can't you, first of all, you can't even communicate with them. And even if you could, they couldn't write those checks. So I think fundamentally that's just something it's on my mind. It's not necessarily where you go with this, but I'm seeing some issues in the way that finance is kind of evolving, that startups may have problems other than just their valuations. You might see startups that have very reasonable valuations that go and do a round with crowdfunding, and then the economy turns a little weird on them. And even with a really nice valuation, the deals I'm talking about, there's nothing to go back to get help around. And then it's really hard to fire up that funding engine and go to new people. So I think founders they have to be very purposeful in terms of valuation, purposeful in terms of, and I know we've said this, Ralph, you and I probably had this conversation 25 years ago and neither of us remembers it with each other, but I'm sure we talked about something about who you take your money from, you know, because we happen to bump into each other, know each other back then. And, you know, it's always been the rule. You don't just take money from anybody. And I think generally speaking, most founders are like, please just give me a check. Just give me a check. But it's true. And the crowdfunding becomes an extension of that. You're taking money from anybody and you no longer have strategy or wherewithal behind that. So I think there's a lot of things like that that founders, and in fairness, they just don't know, you know, unless they've done it before. Failure is a really great learning, you know, it'll steepen the learning curve.
When should you not do a funding round? Like, when is it, like, Series A, Series B?
So you mean when should you think about exit versus funding round, or when do you mean what? Well, just to make sure I understand,
it's just that, like, I'm in Europe, so like there's a lot of companies here that are trying to find alternative methods of like raising capital.
Oh, got it.
Some of them could be in Series C. And they're like, we're gonna do a crowdfunding round. I'm just like, you're crazy. You're way too far. You raised $100 million in your last round. Now you're gonna do crowdfunding. Who's coming in?
No, and it looks horrible. I mean, it's going to look horrible. So, and again, I've got really good friends who are involved with a lot of the crowdfunding platforms, and I think they have a really good space, like a really, they fill a real need in the market. But I think where they make incredibly good sense are those companies that are effectively trying to expand their marketing and their awareness, right? So we've got some phenomenal, one of our founders was the co-founder of Match.com. She founded woman.com, Trustee, which is a cyber verify site. I mean, you're talking about a rock star founder, and she's raised money from huge funds, but then she augmented it with crowdfunding because what her company does is they provide baby gear rental for traveling parents all over the world. And they have thousands of representatives who carry their, I mean, she's doing phenomenally well. Well, you can think about that. That's the kind of deal she's been on Shark Tank too, for the same reason, right?
So it makes sense with the direct to consumer play.
And it makes sense if you're trying to get your name out there, but for a late stage company, not at all. I mean, I think to that, some of them are just screwed, to be blunt, you know, to just put it out there. I mean, if you're a BCDE round company, you're probably taking a down round unless you've got really good support or great traction. That's just the reality. There's not a lot of alternatives. If you're an A round or a B round company, maybe you can put it off. A lot of our teams did really, really well this last 2 years getting grants. I'm not saying that works for everybody, but if you've got real product and you have implication, whether it's in education or government or military or, you know, any number of different fields, energy is a great one. You can get a lot of money in grants, millions of dollars, enough to bridge a little time. Now that's a pain. And you have to have some knowledge and it takes some time, but that's an option that, you know, a fair number of teams have gone to. I guess the best answer I've got is when we start coaching our teams, it served us really well. The reason our survival rate's so high is I tell them to get off the funding train as fast as they can. They need to get to cash flow break even. And to your point, Marcus, some of those are going to fall off because of what's happening in the economy, but there's no question you're in a better position if you can get close to that, if you can get to what I always call bunker state, where you can jump into a bunker and basically survive, right?
I think it's a failure when like startups could say like, hey, we have funding unlimited, it's no problem. They operated a loss with no like profitability margins. Yeah. And then there was like, well, what happened? Interest rates went up. That's not the way the world works. You don't understand.
But we're part of the problem. I mean, my industry is part of the problem, right? We're all of us in some way live in that industry. A lot of the people we work with have never seen this kind of crisis. Yeah. I mean, none of us saw the pandemic, let's be fair. But a lot of people thought that you could just have free or low cost money forever and pretty much unlimited pools of it. And, you know, Ralph and I, you've talked about, you and I have talked about that separately a little bit. And that's, this is a good wake up call. I think, and it's healthy. Look, it sucks. If you're a founder who thought that was the case, it sucks. And you might even have a good business, a relatively good business, but on paper. But yeah. It's a good settle, you know, level set.
Right. This culling always is great. It always works out at the end. But you know, you said something important, and you acknowledge that we are part of the problem. I think we are. And the sooner we acknowledge that, the better, because a lot of times when we do startup funding, we know what the valuation should be, but then we are competing with another fund that wants to give it a higher valuation.
That's a great, great, great point.
Yeah. Mm. You know, and, you know, we just kind of throw that whole rationale out the window.
Yeah, chase the deal.
Yeah. Plus our our funds, we tell them, or our companies, startup companies, we tell them, take enough money. You know, when we ask them what's the use of proceeds, they just give you up to the dollar. And we said, no, 2 years. What happens if things don't work out, right? Yeah. When you talk about the pivot, you know, you have to have money for the pivot or you are screwed. You know, you're looking for a down round now, right? So those are kind of things in the startup world, you know, we are used to, and we kind of try and tell them as much as we can. But then we are the problems where we tell them one thing, but we do something totally different because we don't want to lose an idea.
There's a bunch of really good nuggets in there, a really good point. I mean, the chasing deal or the fighting for deals thing is obviously this huge. It didn't occur to me when I was forming Quake, because again, I wasn't a traditional fund manager, didn't come up through another fund. I didn't realize what a big deal that would be with LPs, with investors in the fund, as to how many deals you would lose. Now, to put this in perspective, though, in 275 deals, 5.5 years, we've lost 3. We've lost one had exited before we got in. We had done diligence, made an offer, and they actually got an offer to buy and were gone before we got in. One we lost to Techstars, one we lost to 500 startups. That's it. And I don't fault those founders. Those were probably good decisions where we were at the time versus where those groups were at that time. But I'm not counting in those losses deals where founders are unreasonable. Like where if we look at a deal and they think they're worth 10 million and we think they're worth 6 or less, and we make an offer and they're not willing to move to where we think it needs to be. We didn't lose that deal. That deal was never structured for us. But it takes discipline, and it's hard as hell to do that. I mean, I cannot, and I'll tell you another thing, you know, talking about, I think you'll appreciate this, talking about our industry and being at fault, there's a stage beyond us that's at fault, which is the pensions, the foundations, the endowments. Now, we don't do, we have a couple foundations. We don't, you know, we have about 75 family offices in our funds, but the endowments and pensions we've been approached by, we would have to move up in class. And I was just at a conference 2 months ago, and a very, very well-known head of a very, very large endowment on stage said, I really hate it when you guys, you know, make bigger and bigger funds and move up class, upstream. Well, if the only way they're going to give you their check is that you move from being a $50 million fund to a $250 million fund, most fund managers are going to make that. There's lots of financial reasons we all know to make that move. So it's very difficult for fund managers to maintain discipline in what they know. I know early stage. We know it really well here. You cannot do early stage with $500 million. I'm sorry. That's bad discipline. You're going to write, the checks you write are too big. It's going to build bad discipline in those founders. you're taking undue risk. There's just lots of reasons, and it's been proven. Y Combinator, in the early days, they had very specific reasons why they wrote the checks they wrote, and it's proven out. But most early stage funds move from seed to A, eventually to B, and they don't know squat about B. So I think we're responsible. The money coming into us is responsible. There's a whole lot of blame to go around here, I guess.
We call the B the sucker round.
Oh, do you really? Now, I want to hear more about that. What's that about?
Well, so the valuation, you know, we know in the startup world what the valuation should be. And the A kind of, because of the baseline, we know what
the B is going to get fleeced. Up,
and the B gets sucked in. Yeah.
Yeah, it's actually, you know, that's been my observation too. And out of my own family office, I don't do anything in that round. I actually don't do anything beyond the A, but that's partly just, again, because of my expertise. But I've seen that for sure.
Yeah, so, you know, A, B, you know, you're right. I see a lot of funds now, just because of all the kind of money that they've got under management, they talk about being, and they're micro VCs to large extent. And when you ask them what kind of investments they're making, they say, well, we're making pre-seed, seed extension A and B. And you're looking at them and saying, what the hell are you guys doing? You know, you are, you know, obviously you are creating a huge delta between those risks.
Yeah. And you're starting to get out where you're, you know, again, like I said, my knowledge isn't there. You're deploying check sizes that are out of proportion to the rest of the portfolio. So if you know, again, you guys are all much better mathematicians probably than I am. Anybody who came up through finance, probably. I was a data science guy though, so that gives me some you know, street cred, I guess. But you need to have some consistency in your investments, right? I mean, if you're doing all these little entry level checks over here that are 150,000, and then you do this off weighted $3 million check over here, that'll crush you. Like, I mean, you can't, you know, if you think about fund returns and how they typically fall. Now, we don't look like this, but you know, there's that one third rule. One third will fail, one third, and you know, who cares, and being, you know, no gain, no loss, and one third makes the portfolio. Well, that goes out the window if you don't have check discipline. And, absolutely. You know, now granted, you want to protect your good stuff. I get all that. But I mean, there's still a point where you're way off of balance.
Yeah, but you are in a, you know, for a startup fund, you're in a good space, I think. There's a lot of layoffs in the talent, in the tech world, close huge. To, I think, what, 300,000 now and counting. A lot of those folks, so the talent pool looks great for hirees, but I personally believe those guys, those tech guys who are being laid off, are becoming entrepreneurs.
You're absolutely right, yeah. For sure. And more so, I think we've always seen that, every downturn we've seen that, but with the pandemic, I think it's way more so.
Yeah, people, and the valuation, like, yeah, the valuation is going to be very, very realistic, not some stupid, outlandish.
And people want a different type of life. They want a different caliber of life. They want a little bit more flexibility. They were not necessarily dealt with the way they had hoped to be dealt with in some places during the pandemic. So I think it was sort of an opportunity where if you were already kind of creatively inclined, I mean, that's me. I don't know about all of you, but that's me. That's why I did so many startups. It's not that I can't work for somebody else, but I love creating. I love building. And I love being around creators. So if you're already kind of that mindset and stuff kind of goes a certain way where it's not very comfortable for you, like the pandemic and, you know, maybe at the beginning of that, not working remotely and then having to come back out of remotely where maybe you like that. A lot of those people are definitely, a lot of the applications we're seeing are large company tech people rolling out. There's no question you're right about that. All the data supports it.
Yeah.
Glenn, we got to wrap it up because Marcus is about to fall asleep, I think. He's in Paris.
Oh, he's in that. That's right. He's way ahead of us. I'm sorry, man.
But I got to tell you, from sometimes we work the late 90s in the
here. So,
Ralph, he is on wine time now.
Yes,
that's right.
But Glenn, I got to tell you this story. We had a company come in the late 90s, and we said we could find money for you at a $12.5 million valuation, and they said no. We want to go out at 40. Right. Yeah. So our banker, Al Vasquez, I don't know if you ever ran into him. Al's a brilliant guy. That's he really says to them, you want to go out at 40? Why? They said, so we can negotiate down. Right. So he says, well, why don't you go out at 100?
Just arbitrarily. Yeah. Founders are hard to figure sometimes. I think it is. I will go back to what Paul said as we close out here, Ralph. I think that any investor who's dealing with a founder, you know, part of that, we always use the term EQ, IQ, right? So we can pretty quickly tell what their IQ is, how they've negotiated and navigated certain things, but their EQ is equally important. Like, how do they interact, right? And so one of the things is, how do they take feedback? You just really, you're in a long-term partnership, 8 years plus if you're in the seed round, right? Well, the plus is a little aggressive, but you're 8 years, you know, 5 to 8 years, really good. That's a good range, right? Do you really want to be stuck with somebody for 5 to 8 years who doesn't ever listen to a damn thing you say and doesn't appreciate the experience and expertise around them? So I think as an event, just the last thing to end this with, I guess from my side would be, that's just a great qualifier for all of us. We keep seeing these high valuations. We keep seeing people who are unwilling to, you know, move or be flexible. Run. I mean, that's discipline.
Ralph sent me an email yesterday, Ralph, with the company. You said they came in at 120. You gave them 10 million?
120. Holy smokes.
Ralph, you're on mute.
An interesting company. They have $1 million of revenues, clients already. It's a healthcare type of company, and they have something like 1,000 patients they're tracking. So, but they wanted $120 million valuation. I said, "There's no way." You know.
Well, some haircut you give them, Ralph.
Well, they're going to see that's a rational number based on what he just described, obviously. And, you know, I think what's going to happen is all these tourists that were coming in dropping huge checks are not dropping those huge checks. And there's going to be that nice reality coming back.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So the hard part about being the investment banker is that, like, if either we have to discipline people right away, or if we believe the story, we just waste a lot of time. And
I have such fond memories as a founder working with investment bankers. Investment bankers in the financial world, to me, are the realists. And I'm not really just trying to kiss ass here. I for me, it was always funny. The rubber met the road when you were talking with the investment bankers. They would tell you how the system really worked, where the money really came from.
Yeah.
You know, what the buyer, like, you know, I did a lot of M&A activity where bankers drove the deal. And that's honestly where I learned how to get out of deals, to be clear.
Glenn, thank you, though.
This is fun.
It's been a great podcast. I'll come back for coffee
anytime. I'll meet Ralph at his place there, and we'll anytime you guys want me.
Ralph, where are you? That's not Florida, is it?
Yeah, I'm in a restaurant because my landscaper cut my internet cable.
Episode 33, The Exit Strategy. We hope you liked it. Like, share, and subscribe. We'll see you on episode 34.